morning to all of you in the United States, and good afternoon to those in Europe, and good evening for those of you following us from Asia. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of OMFIF, and I'm very pleased to be welcoming here today Patrick Harker, who is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. He's been the president for 5 years now, and he's got a very distinguished career in academe, a civil and an urban engineering background. He studied civil engineering at the University of Pennsylvania, something of a lifer at the University of Pennsylvania. He was also the president of the University of Delaware before he took on this job, and he's had a lifetime of exploring different elements of entrepreneurialism from an engineering perspective. I see also, Patrick, that you are a chartered fellow of the National Academy of Inventors, and there can't be too many people on the FOMC with those credentials. We're doing this in partnership with the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, but also with the OMFIF Foundation, which is a not-for-profit group that we set up 3 years ago to explore some of the longer-term elements behind the practice of central banking and indeed institutional management around the world. And Patrick, when you came over to Europe about 18 months ago, we discussed doing this clearly as a physical meeting. We're doing it virtually now because of COVID. Over to you, Patrick. You've got a lot to say, I'm sure, not just about this subject of the entrepreneurial background to AI and machine learning, but also about the Fed itself. No shortage of questions there, bearing in mind the new inflation targeting regime that you unveiled on the 27th of August. We're very pleased to have you with us. Patrick, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much, David. And good morning from the East Coast, and good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this virtual world that we're living in. On behalf of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, I want to welcome you to this virtual conference. We are thrilled to have you here. So as David said, the original plan was for us to meet at our bank in Philadelphia. Instead, I am here in my cramped home office in the right across the river from Philadelphia, New Jersey. We're still planning on having a full-scale conference in Philadelphia with our partners from OMFIF. Around this time next year, God willing, we'll get this virus under control, and we're really looking forward to that. So please stay tuned for details about what will happen in the subsequent months. So even though we're meeting in strange circumstances, many of the old rules still apply. And one of the important ones is the standard Fed disclaimer. The views I express today are mine alone and do not reflect the views of anyone else in the Federal Reserve System or on the Federal Open Market Committee. There, I've covered myself. So we've gathered today to hear a distinguished panel, and they will provide what I am sure will be a fascinating discussion on developments in artificial intelligence and machine learning. But before we get to that, I want to set the table by giving you a brief overview of where I think the economy has been and where it might be heading, recent actions by the Federal Reserve, and a few of my own thoughts on machine learning. All these topics, of course, have been deeply affected by the same scourge that has kept us physically apart today, COVID-19. So let's begin there with where we are with the virus. As you well know, still less than a year after COVID-19 first emerged, the virus has infected more than 30 million people around the world and killed a million. The United States has been particularly hard hit. Because of our country's nearly unique inability to control the virus, we've suffered approximately 21% of the world's deaths, despite housing only about 4% of the world's population. Infection rates have come down from the highs we saw in the spring and summer, but the virus is still circulating widely in large swaths of our country. And even with this disproportionately hard-hit country facing all the challenges we're facing, certain communities have suffered more than others, have faced challenges far beyond what some other communities within the country have faced. Racial minorities, particularly African Americans and Hispanics, have been sickened from the coronavirus at a far higher rate than other groups. They've also, unfortunately, died at a higher rate. And in the ensuing economic contraction, they have lost their jobs at a higher rate. Look, a virus as contagious, deadly, and frankly as mysterious as COVID-19 was bound to have a significant economic impact. Even before, just to think about where we were, even before state and local governments took action this spring, many Americans had already taken action. They stopped dining out, getting on airplanes, and checking into hotels. State and local governments then compounded the economic misery when, and I want to stress, in a responsible attempt to protect public health, they shuttered many businesses deemed non-essential. So what's the upshot? In the second quarter of this year, the United States suffered its worst quarterly GDP drop in recorded history, when the economy contracted at an annualized rate of nearly 33%. 22 million jobs evaporated. Those with low-wage jobs, particularly racial and ethnic minorities, were hardest hit. The good news is, following that contraction, the economy has rebounded faster than many of us had projected. Stay-at-home orders have been lifted, and though large segments of the economy remain depressed, millions of Americans have been able to return to jobs. Indeed, about half of those 22 million residents who were suddenly out of work earlier this year are now back, enough to nudge the unemployment rate down from 10.2% to what is really still a catastrophic 8.4%. For now, I do expect this recovery to continue, though not fast enough that by the end of this year, GDP will return to where it was before the pandemic struck. That will simply take more time. And segments like tourism and hospitality will remain subdued for a long time to come, presenting an overall drag on GDP and employment growth. Employment, unfortunately, probably won't be back to pre-pandemic levels until 2023. Now, I want to caution that this forecast is freighted with uncertainty because, once again, of COVID-19. The scenario of continued growth that I have presented depends on a sustained decline in the rate of new infections, probably a result of nearly universal mask wearing, especially indoors, that ensures only sporadic new outbreaks. We're also assuming that a vaccine becomes widely available sometime mid to late next year. But, and it's a big but, COVID-19, as the world has learned all too painfully, is difficult to control and to forecast. And so the path of the economy largely depends on the path of this virus. It depends in no small part, too, on the path that the federal government chooses to take. When COVID-19 first struck, it brought forth a policy response that, in my view, was commensurate to its gravity. Early on, Congress provided significant fiscal support for the economy through the CARES Act. That blunted the pain of the contraction. Unfortunately, that relief has now expired. And I would urge lawmakers to consider providing additional support soon. For our part, the Federal Reserve's role in responding to the crisis has been robust. But our main power, as you all know, is lending. We cannot simply spend money or issue grants. That is Congress's role. The Fed's role in mitigating this crisis has been to use those lending powers to maintain our underlying economic infrastructure by making sure that every sector of the economy has access to liquidity. Moreover, our lending facilities are meant as backstops to the private sector. We do not want to disintermediate the private sector. We simply want to be there to support market functioning. So, in a nutshell, what have we done? First and foremost, we lowered our policy rate to near zero fast and early. We kept a stance unchanged at this month's FOMC meeting and indicated we plan to keep those rates very low for a very long time. In August, we also announced a long-considered change to how we will balance inflation and employment going forward. Following a nearly two-year review, the Fed announced we will no longer head off higher inflation by preemptively raising interest rates. Moreover, after long periods of sub 2% inflation, as we now find ourselves in, we will accept periods of above 2% inflation. Tolerating the risk of slightly higher inflation, in our view, is worth it if it helps us achieve our employment goals. Using the discount window, we are also actively encouraging banks to borrow money from the Fed at ultra-low interest rates to make sure that they have the funds they need to serve their customers at this critical time. In order to keep markets functioning, beginning in March, we started buying large amounts of Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. We have now purchased more than $2 trillion of these products. The markets, as a result, have largely stabilized, and we've slowed the rate of purchases. As a backstop, we also purchased some corporate debt. And as the economy and credit markets heal, we will disengage from that market as prudently and as expeditiously as possible. Backed by credit protection from the U.S. Treasury, we also launched the Main Street Lending Program, which provides support for small and mid-sized businesses that were in good financial standing before the COVID-19 pandemic. The program was recently expanded to nonprofit organizations such as universities and nonprofit medical institutions, which, as you know, tend to be very important anchor institutions in their communities. Now, there has been somewhat limited interest in Main Street. Only about 400 banks have registered to participate in this program. But in a way, that's actually a good sign for the economy because it means that firms and organizations have access to capital without having to use the Fed. Because if you recall, in all of this, we have designed this just to be a backstop. On the other hand, if there is another major downturn in the economy, these facilities will still be in place to offer funding. We're also bolstering the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, by supplying liquidity to financial institutions that are issuing loans to those businesses that are receiving aid through the program. Now, PPP is now closed to new applications, but when it was open, it drew a lot of interest. More than 5 million loans were issued to the tune of more than $520 billion. Under our program, the Fed provided liquidity to institutions, issuing about 17% of those loans. This is another positive sign for the economy and the financial sector, and it shows the vast majority of banks do have sufficient liquidity to extend credit. We've also rolled out a program to help cash-strapped local governments. The Municipal Liquidity Facility, whereby we buy bonds from municipalities and states whose tax revenues in this crisis have collapsed, is designed to provide essential liquidity as they navigate the twin crises of the pandemic and the subsequent economic downturn. The state of Illinois has already tapped this, and we are opening it up to multi-state agencies like the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey and other transit authorities. The Fed, by merely announcing its existence, did a lot of work in getting private markets functioning again. COVID-19 has affected everything from healthcare to tax receipts to tourism. And so, of course, it has also had an impact on the subject of today's panel discussion, AI and machine learning. Algorithms are built, as you know, on precedent. And so it's a little surprise that as COVID-19 caught governments unawares, it also significantly affected the artificial intelligence that is increasingly used to power large segments of our economy. The algorithms, like all of us, had simply never experienced the set of circumstances that COVID-19 presented. And so many algorithms have seen a deterioration in their performance during this period. Take, for example, credit scores. One would assume that in a time when 22 million Americans had lost their jobs and million more Americans had their hours cut, you would assume that credit scores would have declined. But in fact, the opposite happened. Credit scores have, in the aggregate, risen during this period. One reason for that is even in this economic downturn, delinquencies are actually down because of the aforementioned CARES Act mandated loan forbearance. That was absolutely the right thing to do in my mind, but led the currently used algorithms to the counterintuitive conclusion that default probabilities have in fact decreased. Another consideration going forward will be to ensure that algorithms do not serve to perpetuate the kinds of discrimination that we have seen historically in our financial sector. Will machine learning perpetuate longstanding inequities in, for instance, the rate at which certain racial groups are turned down for loans? This issue requires a conversation, a deep conversation spanning academic fields, computer science, law, economics, and others. And it will also require action from not just regulators, but probably lawmakers too, given that many of the laws governing discrimination date back to 1961 in the United States, back when computers couldn't even fit in a single room. Conversations like the ones we're having today and that we're hosting today hold important implications for the future of our economy and making sure that we're building an equitable future for all of us. In the meantime, we can be rest assured the development of machine learning and artificial intelligence will continue. Although I have to say, I hope it stops before they figure out how to replace me as a Fed president. So again, thank you very much, and I really look forward to the conversation and your questions. Thank you, David.
Thanks very much, Patrick, for taking us on that fascinating journey where you mix together quite a number of themes that we'll be discussing later, including this question of inequity, which you've mentioned. I can see in a number of speeches recently. It's a really important topic that's taking control of central banking minds around the world. We can see that. I start off, please, though, by asking you about the Fed's response, because you mentioned the number of things that you've done. You also issued a very strong call for the federal government or the fiscal authorities in general to do somewhat more and have rather put the ball into their court. Now, if we do go through another bad phase in the economy later this year, this would necessitate a spending package by the fiscal authorities, which would put out the deficit somewhat more. If it, matching that to your balance sheet has remained unchanged more or less in the last couple of months at $7 trillion, even though you did increase it, as you said, very extensively in the early days of the COVID crisis. Are you saying that the Fed is ready to match any increase in the federal borrowing requirement by a pro rata increase in the amount of bonds that you might be purchasing in coming months? Because that seems to me like the one shoe yet to fall, a further increase in the quantitative easing. Can you tell us something about that, please, Patrick?
So I'm not saying that exactly, but I want to step back a little bit. So if I look at, for example, my forecast, built into my forecast is an additional $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus into our economy. If that doesn't happen, from a broad macroeconomic point of view, we're going to see GDP go down several tenths. I mean, the estimates vary, but it's somewhere several tenths. However, if it doesn't happen, it will have a disproportionate effect on the kind of low-income people we're talking about, because we're talking about things like unemployment insurance, continued forbearance or forgiveness of some loans, et cetera. And so that will have a chilling effect on the economy going forward. So I think we just recognize that I, like many forecasters, not just at the Fed, but throughout the financial services sector and the economics profession, have already baked in a certain amount of help on the fiscal side. If the economy, and we're not forecasting another downturn. I mean, I know we're in this world of everybody wants a letter, WV, so forth. I still kind of like the Nike swoosh model. That is, we're going to climb out of this. It's going to be somewhat a bumpy road. It's not going to be a nice, smooth Nike swoosh. It's going to be bumpy as we go up and down, as we see the virus going up and down. And right now, unfortunately, we're seeing in the U.S., we are seeing resurgence. We're seeing resurgence in certain places in Europe and so forth. And that is unfortunate. We've really got to get the virus under control because that is driving everything. And I think that's worth continuing to...
Sorry to interrupt, but what would be the trigger to encourage a further increase in the balance sheet? That's something which many analysts are, of course, asking.
At this point, I don't see the need to do that. What I do see the need for is more fiscal stimulus. That is critical because I actually, if you think about where we are in terms of the macroeconomic situation and our monetary policy stance, I think we are in a very accommodative stance right now. So adding more accommodation, the reason businesses aren't investing or consumers aren't spending isn't because of our monetary policy stance. It's because of the virus. And so I think we keep this accommodative stance that we have today, and we hopefully will climb out of this as we get our hands around and control this virus.
In terms of interest rates, which is something which you ranged over as well, you mentioned the new inflation targeting regime, the average inflation rate, and you said that you would tolerate a rate going above 2%. You'd like to err there on the side of somewhat more risks. Could you tell us, when do you think the averaging period will actually start? Will it start at the time when you started to undershoot the 2%, which would go back 5 or 6 years, or will it start like now? Because this arithmetical question, which must appeal to you as an engineer, is for the financial markets.
Right. So I am an engineer, as you said, and I think there's people think that engineers, there's a stereotype, engineers want everything written down in the equation. I've written down many equations in my life, but this is not a situation where you can write down a simple equation, because there's lots of caveats. So, for example, take two scenarios as a policymaker. One where inflation is moving up over 2%, but moving slowly over 2%, as one roaring past 2%. The policy response is very different depending on the velocity of inflation. So it's not just the level or the time horizon, it's also how quickly it's moving. So yes, you could write down a first and second derivative in the equation and try to formulate that. But I think here is where we use our judgment simply. I mean, I think it's hard to say exactly what that time period is, because again, it's not just the level and the time horizon, but it's also the rate of which change is occurring in inflation.
You mentioned in talking about the disease, contagious, deadly and mysterious. One might say it's also slightly mysterious why it is, but as you said right at the very beginning, a nation such as the United States, with 4% of the world's population, has actually accounted for 21% of the deaths. Without being political, which I know you're not supposed to be, but we do have a big debate coming up later today between the president and the challenger. Do you think the federal government has been somewhat remiss in not taking account of its responsibilities early on to defeat this virus?
So we really didn't have a national federal response, right? It really was state by state. I mean, the state I'm sitting in right now, New Jersey, was part of the early epicenter of this crisis, right? New York, the greater New York region. As a result, this region of the country put in constraints early and kept them there for a period of time. And although we're seeing little bumps up and down in our tri-state region, it seems relatively under control relative to other parts of the country. So that's one issue. It is a big, complicated country. So the question still arises, could we have had one response nationally, given the size and scope of the United States? I tend to lean toward, personally, that would have been a better solution than what we've seen. But again, that's not for me as a monetary policy decision maker to say.
It's quite clear that you are there for monetary policy decision making, but we've all become amateur epidemiologists these days. There is a human factor. Would you say quite cold-bloodedly that a certain number of extra deaths over and above the seasonal average amongst older people or people with underlying health issues is something that we just have to put up with as part of normalizing the economy?
I hope not. I mean, again, I'm not an epidemiologist. We do collaborate with leading epidemiologists in this country and in our region. There's no question that metric actually is one of the metrics I look at, is deaths above the baseline, the normal baseline deaths that we have. Because there are a lot of measurement issues with COVID, right? Depending on how much testing is happening, how deaths are classified. But if you just look at the baseline versus deaths above that baseline, we've clearly seen that increase pretty significantly. There's two things I'm worried about. It's that the deaths are only one measure. The other measure, though, that we still don't quite understand, and we all know these stories, right, of people whose health has been significantly compromised, although they were fortunate in that they did not die from the disease, they have now conditions that are pretty severe going forward. And we don't quite know the cost of that to society, right? In terms of how many people will have to go on disability because they can't work because they've lost lung capacity, or I have somebody close to our family who lost heart capacity because of a heart attack that was created by COVID. So we don't know that cost yet. We're still in the midst of all this. So it's very hard to forecast.
I'd like to get on to some of the industrial issues in a moment. We've got one or two questions coming in already from the audience on that. But first of all, I'd like to stay on this big social issue, which you mentioned right at the beginning, the gap between richer and poorer, inequality and so on. There's many people and a certain body of academic research that says that since quantitative easing started in a big way 10 years ago, this has actually increased the gap between rich and poor because it's inflated the value of assets. We've had recently the Black Lives Matter movement gaining ground, but this has been an underlying issue in the United States for many, many years. Why is it that central banks and central bankers, particularly your friends and colleagues on the FOMC, only relatively recently have you started really talking about this big time? I've noticed this. Why is this? Is this because of the underlying political background we have in the United States, or is it because you've suddenly become aware that this is really a big question that really does matter?
So I can speak for Philadelphia. We've had activity and work in this area now for decades through our community development function. We actually launched several years ago, prior to any of this, something called the Economic Growth and Mobility Project, really looking at helping to move people into the middle class, into solid middle class jobs. What's different now is we're actually calling it what it is. Underlying many of these issues, there is the question of racial inequity that we just need to call out. You have to name it so you can solve it, right? You have to define a problem before you can actually try to solve it. And so I think what's different now is that we're publicly saying that more, but the work's been going on for decades. I can tell you in Philadelphia, we've been doing this work now for quite a while. We have a very active program in Philadelphia and really across the Fed that's been going on now for at least a year and a half on racial equity. It's called the Racial Equity Learning
Committee. Have you seen any concrete results, any beneficial results from this?
So I'll give you one example. So we've had local communities in our district in Philadelphia who have come to us saying, this is a problem. What do we do with it? These are community leaders in these communities saying, we want to do something. So we've put together training programs for them with some outside help to help them come up with a plan that they can implement in their community to help move the needle on these issues. This is not going to be solved with a one-size-fits-all all across America. This is not going to happen. But I think we can provide, one of the things we provide at the Fed is that convening authority in the research. So we've been doing underlying research around this for quite a while. We're now bringing that together into these communities so the communities can go come up with plans that actually make a real difference.
Could you conceive that the mandate, the same as dual mandate that you have, which is already wider than some other countries have it, that this could be extended into what you might call the social equity area?
No, I think the Congress has given us a dual mandate. So we are a creature of Congress, so it's up to Congress if they wanted to change that mandate, obviously. That said, I take very seriously as a policymaker both the wealth and the income gaps. And again, when we talk about gaps, we really need to distinguish those two gaps. What we saw prior to the pandemic, as unemployment was going below all of our estimates of what the natural rate was really good news, right? We were starting to close that unemployment gap, and people were starting to get into better and better jobs, what we call in our research in Philadelphia, opportunity occupations, jobs that pay above median wages, right? Get you into the middle class, life-sustaining, family-sustaining jobs. That's great news. So that's how you're going to close the wage gap, right? The income gap. The wealth gap has long historical roots, right? There's this hysteresis of this that go back to the redlining days. I think there are different policy responses, mostly not in the hands of the Fed. I would say the vast majority not in the hands of the Fed to help address those underlying issues that have been around for a long time.
I've noticed that many of the FOMC members have indeed been cajoling the fiscal authorities to do more on the fiscal side. It's quite unusual. The boot is on the other foot. We're quite used to the governmental authorities, particularly a certain incumbent in the White House, to tell you what to do, but you're now telling them what to do. Could you give them some advice? And this is a question from the audience here regarding the expected $1 trillion in new fiscal stimulus. What is the timing? Because it may well soon be too late the benefits to actually help?
So I, there's some people, you look at certain industries that have been hard hit, tourism, travel generally, you look at the airline industries and so forth. They're going to be laying people off or not bringing people back. It's just now, some of that we will have to transition people to those different careers. So I think the help has to be transitioning them financially right now. Also, really doubling down on innovative, creative ways of job training to bring people from one career to the next. So it's not just the fiscal help of helping state and local governments that need it or unemployment insurance expansion to help people, but it's also really thinking about how do we move people from that low wage job to a higher wage job. There's research that we've done with our colleagues at Cleveland that I'm really excited about. They looked at lower wage jobs and said, given those skill sets of those jobs, map those jobs to a higher wage job, at least 10% more. They looked across 33 metro areas in the United States. Roughly half the jobs they looked at had a companion where they could map from lower wage to higher wage. With an increase annually in salary, that was quite significant. I mean, roughly $15,000. So this, but to do that, we need creative public-private partnerships. We've helped spawn one in Philadelphia with Comcast and the local Philadelphia Job Training Board. And our website has information on that. But this is where we need to go. If we're going to really move the needle and really address, go back to the racial equity question, get people out of the lower wage careers that they have to help them move up, it's time to do that. And this is, so it's not just giving money to people, it's helping them get to that next level.
Looking at the programs of the two candidates and not mentioning their names, which of the two programs you think is more likely to reduce this narrowing of the gap of racial, social, and income inequity that we have in the United States right now?
So I think we're putting it too much on one individual and one plan. I think it really has to be a concerted effort by business and government entities and nonprofits. This has to be a full court press, to use a basketball analogy, right, to really go after this with all organizations. We just have to focus on it. I think this is the moment to focus on it.
This is quite a new thing, because I've heard this recently also from people like Raphael Bostic or Robert Kaplan or Charlie Evans. The central banks of the world and the Fed in particular have been used to wielding big, heavy sticks to bludgeon certain changes in performance. Think of Paul Volcker and inflation and so on. You're now starting to talking about not so much wielding a big stick or a bludgeon, but more a whole series of different rapier-like thrusts, to use the research, to use the acumen, to use the knowledge, to use the instruments of the Federal Reserve to try to bring about what is, in a way, a kind of change in the social engineering. Is that the new way forward for the Fed?
See, I don't think it's social engineering. I actually think, you know, the IMF has done this research. If you increase the wealth of the top tier of our society, GDP falls. If you increase the income of the bottom tier, GDP rises, for a very simple reason, right? I mean, if you put money into the hands of people who are going to spend it pretty quickly, you're going to see that multiplier effect in GDP. I think there's a solid economic reason why we care about this. Increased wealth and income disparity slows down the economy, right? And because we have all this talent sitting on the sideline, and we saw this prior to the crisis. We had all this talent sitting on the sideline who didn't have the skills to take the jobs that people desperately were looking for. And again, we're not talking about people with PhDs. We're talking about good jobs that don't require a college degree, plumbers, electricians, you can go down the list. Right now, even in this country, even though we're just coming out of this pandemic, housing has taken off in a major way. Those skills are still needed, and the companies I've talked to can't find them. So I think there's a good economic reason that we should care about this, in addition to other social reasons why we should care about it.
Okay, well, if I could just turn to a more macro issue, which is the dollar. Now, I know it's the Treasury that speaks about the dollar, but right, there must be some worries also amongst the people who follow the Federal Reserve, that if you're really throwing the kitchen sink at this 2% inflation rate, you are going to take some risks. It could be by letting inflation go above 2%. Is that a worry for you, that you could be undermining the rock on which the dollar as the world's supreme currency is based?
There are lots of risks to worry about. That one is not high on my list right now. I mean, it's always on the list, but it's not high on my list right now.
But when you see other nations, like, say, the European nations who've been talking over the years and making the euro into a really powerful currency that could be rivaling the dollar, do you say, like Clint Eastwood, go ahead and make my day?
No, I think we just continue to do what we've been doing. And at this point, again, there may be some point in the future where I'd be concerned about that. What I'm more concerned about right now, and one of the issues that we've been doing actually a lot of work and convening in Philadelphia on and across the system, is around digital currency, central bank digital currency. It's an area that I think requires further exploration. I'm actually quite supportive of the work my staff's done and others on this topic. So that, to me, is one of the areas where, in addition, I think that's one where we really need to start focusing our attention.
Well, I'm very pleased you mentioned that, because that's one of the parts of the landscape where OMFIF has done a lot of work. We recently set up this new group, which we call the Digital Monetary Institute. We've got a lot of interest in that. Are you interested and or concerned by the fact that China is leaping ahead in the digital currency stakes, the People's Bank of China, for all sorts of reasons, some good, maybe some less good, is really pioneering this question of a digital currency? Some people say this is all part of a command and control system, and there's a lot of people worried about the encroachment of digital currencies into civil liberties, privacy, anonymity, and so on. How do you square the balance? How do you set the right line there if you're talking about digital currency? Right. People do like that money because they think it's anonymous, the dollar note.
Right. So you're right. There are lots of issues. That's why this is worthy of discussion, research, dialogue. We need to be cognizant of all the other players. It's not just other nation states, but it's also the private sector currencies that are emerging. This landscape's changing relatively quickly. And this is where we need to be in the midst of that, trying to have conversations to understand it and see where our role is in all of this.
But it's something where I'm very pleased you have said that you're taking an interest in all that, because you have the feeling that the Europeans are a couple of years behind the Chinese, and America, in terms of this digital currency area in general, one has the feeling maybe 5 years behind. You're clearly not, or at least you're trying to make up the gap. Some people believe that indeed the countries that can command this new digital space will indeed be able to use their currencies internationally for all sorts of reasons. Talk about the Belt and Road, for example, in China. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of constructive, but also other slightly less constructive reasons why you might want to command the digital currency area. Do you think there are, you might say, security and national policy areas involved in this seemingly arcane question of digital currencies that they actually do intrude into the international political sphere?
Sure. I mean, there are those concerns with our current versions of digital currencies. That is money flowing around our financial system today. And, you know, so that is an issue that will continue to be an issue. It's one of many issues that we need to discuss as we work out what our policy stance should be relative to digital currencies.
Well, I look forward to engaging further with you on that. I'd like to ask you, since you mentioned the machine learning, a couple of questions from the audience on all this. One is in your home region, in the region of Pennsylvania, how far advanced are you, would you say, on a world basis in terms of this whole AI field? Where would you, if you were running, say, the University of Pennsylvania rather than the Fed, where would you put your dollars in terms of expanding learning and expanding the sectoral knowledge in this field?
I think the question of not just AI, machine learning, but advanced computing technology, quantum computing, is also another area that we have some interest in. I have some personal interest in, and our team in Philadelphia does. These are moving apace. They are changing the landscape, the modeling that we can do, and the speed at which we can do this. And so, yeah, I would make sure we're putting significant investment in research and development in those fields, no question about it.
And the question from the audience is, how do you think the COVID pandemic will affect the development of a fully functioning and self-sufficient artificial intelligence? I think the question is, maybe a bit open-ended, this question. So could I maybe make this a bit narrower and talk about just the United States in terms of where do you think the pandemic will make a difference, either positively or negatively?
So I think, what I said in my prepared remarks, what we're seeing right now is judgment still matters in major turning points, right? Machine learning and AI tend to do very well in a relatively stable environment, right? It's because we've trained it on data, it's learned from that data. But when we have a significant shock, a black swan, right, that appears like COVID-19, algorithms have a hard time dealing with that because they've never seen it. Frankly, we have a hard time dealing with it because we've never seen it. But this is where human creativity, judgment comes to play, right? I mean, this is where we can't rely so much on the algorithms. I use one example, credit scores, but there are many others we could use, where human beings have had to intervene to make decisions because they can forecast, or at least attempt to forecast, the future. It's very difficult to see in the data because we've never been there before. Now, again, may disagree, but that's my view.
Well, we have to presume that there will be more pandemics coming along, maybe far more deadly, far more mysterious, but also far more deathly than this one. Do you think that we will seriously be making strides on the arithmetical side, shall we say, through algorithms and so on, not just on the epidemiological and the vaccine side, but also in the metrics? Do you think we'll be really making progress worldwide on this virus in this period to help us better withstand the next crisis? We know there will be one.
So my reading of the science, for example, what's happening, and some of the recent science out of Oak Ridge National Labs and other places, is that what we're seeing underlying our response to COVID-19, this rapid response and development of vaccines, potential vaccine candidates, is all due to the advances in computing technology, right? And AI, machine learning, and just the speed of the machines and the complexity of the machines that we're able to throw at this problem. That will accelerate. So I'm actually, and this may be the engineer in me, I'm actually a cautious optimist. I think that technology, broadly defined, and in particular what we're talking about today, and hardware, can make a significant difference in how quickly we can respond to the next unforeseen circumstance. That's the hope. And I think that's what we're trying to build toward.
I just want to end up on asking you a couple of questions, really of a slightly wider nature. One is about China, because bearing in mind what you've just said about teaming together fine minds and research, both in the algorithmic and the AI field, but also in the vaccine and the epidemiological field. You are non-political. There's been lots of talk about China, a lot of hostile talk. Do you not think that it is time to have some kind of alliance with the Chinese, whether we like their policies or not, on defeating not just this virus, but the next one?
Absolutely, not just China, but really, pandemics, viruses don't know boundaries. They don't know political systems. They go where they go. And so a host of challenges we face globally, whether it's increasing pandemics, climate change, we can go through the list of all the challenges we face as a human race on this planet that's getting increasingly small with technology. You think about how we got here, right? Transportation technology alone. We focus a lot on AI machine learning, but the efficiency of transportation technology alone has brought the world much smaller. So given all that, I think we have no choice but then to collaborate on these global issues that we're all facing.
We're talking about what seems to me like a fairly wide-ranging remit for central banks these days when you look at the number of issues that you have to confront. And it seems and you could make a kind of algorithm out of this. The less influence you have short term with your monetary policy tools, the more you seem to be talking about much wider issues now. And that gets you into the political sphere, and you get into the time hallowed question of Federal Reserve independence. Now, we've been used to a certain gentleman in the White House castigating the Fed over the last 3 or 4 years for various reasons, mostly because interest rates have been going up. This gentleman has been quiet lately. Is this a good or a bad sign?
So my view, sort of more broadly, is The Fed has a limited set of tools and our ability to do research to lay out facts, right, in an objective way. And I'm very proud of the work that we do across the system on this. But those tools, we have to recognize the limits of those tools. We can talk about all the problems we're talking about today, racial equity, inequity, and so forth, but they're not in the hands of the Fed to solve fundamentally. They are issues that reside in Congress and in state and local governments all across the country. And so we can just call it out what it is. I'm not prescribing any policy response, but I think we can recognize this is the cost of having racial inequity. This is the cost of not dealing with climate change, and let other entities decide what the appropriate response is. But I think it's incumbent upon us to say, if we don't deal with these things, the economy will suffer, and here's why.
Good. Well, thank you very much indeed. We've left a lot of questions, of course, open and unanswered, and that will continue to be the case, I think. But we have set out a pretty wide remit. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Patrick Harker. I look forward very much to getting together with you in Pennsylvania, in the university, meeting your industrialists, doing all the things we said we were going to do 18 months ago. Thank you very much indeed for your time today.